I'm here at the Venice Biennale in the Albanian Pavilion with Eddie Muka, the curator. We're looking now at the work by Astrid Vatnikai.
These are photocopies of Albanian passports, referring to the phenomena that almost each Albanian has quite a lot of number of passports with several different identities. Therefore, the passport as an identity carrier doesn't really matter to an Albanian. It's not significant at all. It's just a way to leave the country and go abroad. Even identity is not important, you know. So if before it was an imposed loss of identity, at this moment there is this self-imposed loss of identity.
Moving through the pavilion, we have here rather marvellous video work. If you'd like to talk about that.
The artist is Anri Sala. Anri, just by chance, found a 16mm film where there was an interview of his mother while during the time of communism when she was someone important, you know. But because of the time, there was no sound anymore. So the artist decided to decode this interview. And for that, he took it to a deaf and mute institute and decoded the entire interview. And about all this process, he didn't tell anything to his mother. And at a certain moment, while filming, he goes home and says her, come and sit down because I have a surprise for you. And then he plays the video, you know, and she is astonished by the interview he had found. And then he starts interviewing her now, asking, what did you say by that time? And she really can't understand what she was saying. And then he translates it to her because, you know, he has the decoding from the institute, you know, and she doesn't believe it, you know. And then the interview extends further and further in nowadays in Albania, including the events we gone through the year 97, 98, and so on and so forth. Opinions of his mother about his future, about her worries, and so on. And it also, since it includes such a wide range of phenomena seen in Albania, it talks about difficulties, about political prisoners, about many things Albania had gone through during this period, you know, he's including in his video.
So we're now looking at the work of Alban Hardini, and the artist is here with me now. So would you like to talk a little bit about how these pieces came about?
Yeah, I can say that there are two different works that make the whole piece, two extremes of the same reality. The first one is inspired by the tragic reality that I can find in my country, and the second one is.
So we're looking at torsos encased in these military boxes.
Yeah, and the second one is maybe it seems a little comic. These little objects are not just some kitsch objects. They are fake objects that are a symbol of our fake progress.
And with Lala Meredith Vula, looking at her work in the Albanian Pavilion. Lala, you're based in Britain, in fact, but you've come and exhibited here.
Yes, my mother's British and my father's from Kosovo. And I was invited by the Albanian government to come and show in the pavilion. And as all my work is based in Kosovo and Albania, it's sort of relevant to the pavilion.
You've got a series here of large, wonderful black and white photographs taken in a bath.
I sort of came across this, and I went in and washed myself, and I was incredibly inspired by the way the women were scrubbing each other's backs, the old crumbling architecture. This is a bath that's 500 years old, and it reminded me of all the paintings like I've seen, like Degas. It reminded me of, you know, Matisse, when you see the stars and the figures. And I was just so inspired that I really wanted to do a piece.
And you've chosen to work in black and white. Why did you make that decision?
I did them in colour as well, but the feeling is more diffused in colour.
When I was speaking earlier with the curator, he was saying what's so fascinating about bringing all the work together is both the incredible integrity about the work, but the differences between everybody and the multiplicity that you see here. And I think that is wonderful because all the work is so different, and yet it's all from a very passionate core. Lala, as we mentioned earlier, you felt you'd like to mark this occasion of Kosovo being liberated by singing an old folklore song. It's 500 years old, and I believe it's about identity.
Oy zogo, oy zogo, yelek mevia. Oy zogo, oy zogo, yelek mevia. Ay kepa, shochete mia. Ay kepa, shochete mia. I kampa, nan yehiye.
Yeah! I'm here with Meir Aronson outside the Israeli Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. It's an amazing show you put together here. Can you tell me a little bit about how it came together and how you came to choose the artists that you have exhibiting here?
The name came out naturally, almost without hesitations, because they are from a group that I'm working with. And I asked myself several questions before I decided to take them. I asked myself, is it important that it is the last Biennale of the millennium? Is it important that in a year we are in the next millennium? So I decided that I'm not going to do a pyrotechnic exhibition of show off, and I don't want to criticize anyone, but I don't want to make a fashion show. I wanted to do a very heavy, in quotation, but an exhibition that will force the people to think. History is a flashlight for future. You cannot go to the future without knowing the history. You will do all the possible mistakes again and again if you will not remember. So this is the subject of the exhibition. It's not the Jewish Holocaust, and I want to emphasize it. It's a Holocaust as a concept. It's a Holocaust as something that humans create. It's not a natural disaster. It's not a hurricane. It's not a uncontrolled forces. We are changing positions from hunter to hunted without even feeling it. This is the subject of the exhibition.
I'm here with Simcha Schiedemann at his exhibition. Mm-hmm. And what you've managed to produce here is not only a very evocative installation, which is about history's memory, mm-hmm. but also these wonderful black and white photographs. And I'd just like you to talk a little bit about the selection of what you have here and a little bit about the history, about the work here mm-hmm. today.
Like when I knew that I was going to be part of this exhibition, I decided to take a trip to Germany and from there to go to Auschwitz by a train and take pictures in Auschwitz. Like while traveling in Germany, and Germany is the place that I was born in, I was fascinated by the Hunter Tower. For me, it represented in a way what they call the German landscape. So like 10 years ago, being in Auschwitz and in Dachau, I was fascinated by the watchtower. The specific watchtower of Auschwitz in relationship to watchtowers that are all around us, especially in Israel, that is surrounded by long borders. So I decided to do an interpretation and to deal with a dialogue with the two towers, the Hunter Towers and the Watchtower, in relationship to territories in a way, because it's a monument that has to do with the past, but it's also an object that has to do with the present, and with my own present experiences. It has to do with the site, with the anonymous, with the person that is there or not there. It has to do with memories. It has to do with landscape changing into territories of death or something else, depends on the point of view on the, and the situation. So I think that all this, in combination to the past history and memory, the thing that I experienced and didn't experience, my being an Israeli and a Jewish living in Israel, I found it as a very good way for me to stop for a second and raise questions, you know, about reality, relationship of art and reality, reality and art, past and present, the way they are linked together to the future in a way. This is why, like, two of the images are the images of the skyline, you know, it represents, I mean, water that are representing, like, the wild nature with the idea of looking and longing.
These series of photographs have no people in them. They are, as you say, about the landscape, the watchtowers. And then in the middle of this room, we also have this piece here with mm-hmm. the rifle pointed at monitors.
Yeah, like the installation is actually built of two spaces. One space is the space that the viewers, I mean, the people that are coming into the installation, are in this space being watched by other people that are staying in the other space. Now they're being watched by three cameras that are putting their images on three television screens. Now the minute you walk up into the upper space and you stand up in front of the screen and the gun there, you know, as an object, you're becoming aware to the fact that you were watched before by other people, and now you have the choice to change from being hunted into a hunter. Now, you don't have the choice most of the time to be watched, but you do have the choice to become a hunter or not. So it's raising, in a way, a dilemma and making everyone to participate. It's also a kind of a game that you play in Luna Park and a video game. In our, like, technology and the way we live, I think it's a very important and very interesting question, like the relationship between all this instrument, again, in relationship to reality. What, I mean, you are playing a game, but what this game means to you and how it reflects what's happening outside.
As we move down to the mm-hmm. lower part of the gallery, you've again worked with an installation piece, but also included your photographic mm-hmm. works again, all in black and white. So the image is very much of these white ceramic tiles mm-hmm. and then the frame pieces. If we start here with these two very evocative pieces of the sea and then move around past the urinal pieces and end with the sink.
This space, in a way, is representing the idea of the public space and the way you can control people's life by the way you create public spaces. The minute you destroy the privacy of a person and you turn him in a way into an animal, you're controlling, you know, like most of people will survive in this situation if they can ignore it or find a way to deal with it, or they'll die, you know. Now part of all this idea is to do with the way we deal with our body, you know, something that belongs to us and something that is totally open to the public. Now again, this control water, I'll always, in most of my installation, I'll put an image of the sea. Number one, I love the sea. I found it very powerful, very strong. I grew up all my life in a city that is sitting on the sea in Israel. I love the horizon line. It represents the uncontrolled water, longing, going places and coming back home, mythology and reality. And it's also a window, you know, from this like inner space that is controlling you. You have a window, you know, to the outside in a way, although it's only an image, you know, but it represents in a way a window to the outside.
The other thing that struck me very much looking at the work is on the third urinal we have this incredibly evocative portrait mm-hmm. of a girl who is soon clearly to go to her death. The other end is a portrait of yourself with your very specific signature. Perhaps we could talk about your signature and also the other portrait of mm-hmm. the young girl.
Yeah, like there are three portraits. Each portrait is standing above a urinate. I'm playing some kind of a game. It's like the TV set and the gun. And you're facing the wall in order to gain your own privacy, and then the face looking back at you, in a way destroying it. And it's also like if you look at the portrait, you're standing in front of the urinate, and if you're standing in front of the urinate, there is a portrait looking at you. So it deals again with this idea of controlling space and the situation. Now, two of the portraits are portraits of two women that got killed in Auschwitz. That on my visits to Auschwitz, when I was just fascinated by the way they looked, like wearing this prison dress, their hair was cut, still smiling and still so beautiful, I found it fascinating. So I took this picture and I decided to use it in the work. Now I was adding to this my self-portrait with my signature that says SS. This is the initial of my name. It's playing again on the duality of the name. With the number of my birthday and the actual finishing of the war. And for the last 10 years, from the day, you know, we celebrate, it's not right, but we have the Memorial Day of the Holocaust. It just happened that around almost 10 years ago, the Memorial Day of the Holocaust and my birthday fell on the same day. Since then, this is the way I sign all my goals, you know, the initial of my name and the number.
And then also linking, in the middle, linking these images together is, of course, the piece of the sink with the tap running.
Water running into a glass, and the glass is fulfilled, the water running out. It has to do, again, with, in a way, a modern, you know, Baudelaire is talking about nature represented in water in a glass, you know, water that is contained. It has to do with life, it has to do with the ceremony of cleaning. And in a way, you know, as part of the whole installation, it has to do with images that we remember from the past, with images that represent our everyday life.
I mean, how has the Venice experience been for you, being here? I mean, you've been here the whole time talking to people. People have been relating very emotionally, actually, to your work.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's again, going like on two levels, like the artistic level, that makes me very happy. You know, it's a dream that almost every artist has, you know, to represent this country in Venice. I think it's a fascinating experience.
Level now of the Israeli Pavilion with the artist
Philip Ranzer
to talk about his installation piece. Philip, can you tell me a little bit about the background of this piece, which has these incredible sounds of children crying?
I never planned something. It's like to go to a kind of adventure. I mean, I start to work, and then the work take me in a way with her. So this work come, like always, from intuition. I knew that I wanted to use a crying child because I felt that there is something in the crying, very ambivalent. Most of my works deal with ambivalent things, and I feel that most of the art dealing with this in-between. So, and I think the crying child, in one way, is asking for help, and in the other way, he is doing also manipulation. But, you know, I prefer to hear the audience, what they are feeling or what they get from my work, because I feel that when I finish the work, I also finish to say something. I mean, I'm not important anymore, because my work is a kind of trigger. And I hope that this trigger do something to the person who look at this. It's quite embarrassing that I have to speak about my work, not because I don't know how to speak, and I'm not so so shy. But I feel that it's not necessary. It's not necessary because I think it's a very narrative work, and what is behind the work, it depends on you. If there is behind, yes. If you have behind, you will find it. So I'm out already.
I just wanted to talk about, on top of your work, you have these large fairy toys that their tummies inflate and breathe in a way. You have a feeling of them breathing.
I don't remember my toys. I remember that I had the toys, and I remember that I loved them very much. And I try to come with this feeling. We always don't want to separate from our childhood. And now, what I'm trying to do, that the childhood don't want to separate from us. So also the point of view that I put the floor in top and the furniture down, it make your point of view, it's a point of view of a child.
I'm here at the Nordic Pavilion with Jean-Peter Nielsen, who has curated the show. Jean-Peter, I'd just like you to tell me a little bit about why you chose these particular artists, and also a little bit about them and the work that's here.
When I got the job, I was thinking about what is it that is typical or what is interesting in the end of the millennium right now. For a long time, I think I'm very interested in the way that we are living in a very public world today, where mass media is playing a big role. But where are the private lives? Where are our own dreams, our own desires, our own fears gone? So I had this idea too, because I've seen this for a couple of years, this sort of trend happening where artists are trying to find a new way of dealing with their own lives. Very often it's about also dealing with their own fears. And if you look at the show, the photographs by Annika von Hauswolf, it's like the interior in a very traditional way, but it's not happy interiors. It's like there are lots of absurdities, there are lots of fears, depression. And if you look at Iris Ahtila's work, it's about a couple that is separating and all the emotions that they're going through. And if you look at the Norwegian Knut Aasland's box, it's a nature. Nature is supposed to be pure, but here it's like inverted the garden into a night garden. It's not little during the night, there's a grow light system, and you enter in broad daylight into a dark wood, basically. And it's both scary, but it's also like a zone where everything can happen.
And it smells as well. It has a very particular musty, woody smell.
Right. The show is very much about dealing with some kind of insecurities, also about feeling lost. I think that most of us, at least in a pretty well middle class Western societies, can afford to go to an airport and buy a ticket and go wherever. But having this feeling of not knowing where to go, and that kind of an emotion is a sad feeling, but at the same time it's about a sad feeling about the welfare state society. Basically, it's like the 20th century has sort of like stressed the fact that we are equal all over the world. We're living in a universal world. But what happened with that, as I see it, is that we lost our personal rooms, our private rooms. And I think that art today, I think being a human being today, is like very much to try to re-establish some kind of personality. Maybe personality is not the right word, but some kind of a feeling of having a place where you feel okay. That doesn't mean that you have to have a home, or it doesn't mean that you have to have a nation, but that you feel a little bit content with your own identity, your own life. The subtitle of the show is End of Story. It's end of the story that whatever the building represents of late modern architecture is about. The end of the story that is about that we are all inscribed in the same universal pattern. I really honestly think that that story is ended. But how to deal with new stories, you know, like how to deal with the fact that the world has shrunk, but it's also becoming so big at the same time. There's so many new cultures, there's so many new personalities, etc., in the world today, and we have to learn how to cope with that. And I think that art, culture in general, is one of the few fields, zones in a society that can deal with it.
I'm here with Annika von Hauswolf outside the Nordic Pavilion. Annika, just tell me a little bit about the series of works that you've done for this exhibition, some of the background behind them, and a little bit about yourself.
Mm. Well, the series is a new body of work. It's all interiors. Some rooms are empty, and some rooms have people, sometimes lonely persons, and sometimes there's two persons, and it's a relation kind of drama, you could say, actually. And before, I used to stage my photographs mainly outdoors. I used the landscape as a fond for my ideas, but this time I decided to go inside rooms to depict various mental states, I would say.
It comes out very clearly, I think, in the work. One particular piece I was very drawn to was the stockings in the sink, because it's very simple, very evocative. Mm. And also, you work in colour, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about the way that you present your work.
Well, I'm using colour negative film. Which
what
is,
camera do you use?
I use a Mamiya. You say this Japanese 6x7 centimetres negative format. And I use the colour negative because it's softer than the Cibachromes. I'm thinking actually of doing a black and white project, because I started out as a documentary photographer. I got my education in that field, and that's what I wanted to become. But gradually I started to do staged photography instead. But I'm using still this language of the documentary photography, because, yeah, it serves my purposes, you could say. So then I mount these color negative prints on plexiglass.
You attach the plexiglass
with silicone
to the image.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very sculptural.
Yeah,
and
yeah, it is actually. That's interesting that you're mentioning it, because I've been thinking a lot about sculpture when I'm.
It looks
doing
to me very. Yeah. The piece really works as a sculptural piece.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's very
Although
beautiful.
Although it's super flat, I've been really, you know, thinking about the sculptural elements more this time than any other time, actually. Started out with the bubbles. I don't know if you're familiar with that work, but it had a notion of sculptural. Now, I like the images to be very present in the room. That's why I make them quite large, and I don't use a frame.
They're floating.
Yeah, it's a continuum.
I felt they related extremely well to the architectural space of the pavilion.
Which
they
is really special, this architect's
house.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's so difficult to display art in it,
yes.
But I think we solved it in a very nice way by building these two boxes for
it's
the other
sold,
art pieces.
Yes, yeah. It's worked extremely well.
It's tight. It's tight exhibition, I'd say.
Yes, it's lovely.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to say, I mean, about your work or your working practice, really?
I regard myself to be working in a traditional way with pictures. I often use paintings as inspiration.
You use art historical background.
Yeah. Yeah.
For these works, I think your earlier series of works, the art historical inspiration was more obvious,
more obvious,
more
exactly.
evident.
Yeah.
With these ones, did you have an art historical starting point?
Not really.
It's more nebulous, I think, if you did.
Yeah. Composition-wise, I do look at Vermeer, for instance, and Edward Hopper I use a lot as an inspiration. So I think I use that way of composing images, and I mix it with this documentary.
But you're using your
language.
Own language of composition now.
Exactly.
Okay, this is an interview with Elisa Artila and talking about her work in the Finnish Pavilion Consolation Service. It's two-screen projection, both images butting up on the same wall, and it tells a story about a couple who have a young child who are separating. There is, in addition to the couple and their baby, a counsellor who is offering this consolation service who appears, and several non-speaking parts played by observers, which maybe we'll talk about later. And then there is a neighbour. And the narrator is living in the same vicinity as the neighbour, who has a dog, and this couple. Like many of your other pieces, this seems to be very concerned with the possibility or the impossibility of making connections, of communicating, of coming to an understanding between two people of how this might be possible and what kinds of things might cause that communication to break apart.
Yes, certainly. I mean, it's one of the basic things of being here, living here, to my identity and identity in general. It has to do with the other person, and that means communication, that means kind of defining your life.
With reference to your mentioning of identity, that seems to be something that arises, in a sense, out of the things that one does. It's never that you simply have a sense of identity and then you go and do things. That you have that sense of identity because you are in a relationship with someone, because you are having a baby, or whatever. And once those things, those actions, are over, then who you are, again, is called into question.
When you are not a child anymore, that you are an adult. Temes used this word, camouflage. I think identity has a lot to do with that also, that there are some static parts in identity, and that the camouflage is not only a negative word. But I'm saying that you also really need the camouflage, that it's not nothing extra in you or nothing that you should put a lot of energy to get rid of it.
That idea of there being static elements and dynamic elements within one's sense of identity pervades the work. Although one particular moment in this work, Consolation Service, where it happens is when JP, the man in the couple, is talking to the counsellor, saying that he's going to go out for his birthday drinks on that night. And she asks who's going to look after the baby, and he says, well, the neighbour will. She's the person who's telling this story. And so immediately there is, as you say, that recognition that it's not simply acting. It may be acting that is going on in front of us, but there is also another level at which there is something graspable. It also connected with the way that I've experienced some of your other works, where they are, in some senses, much more obviously using the space and requiring the viewer to make active decisions about where he or she is going to stand or sit or whatever. So you maybe have two or three screens that are at different angles. Whereas here, it's not that, as we say, it's not on one wall. And yet, the viewer is still involved in a similar kind of way.
Yeah, this is really different work in that sense, because this is actually my first work where I really concentrated on building the fictional world. Almost all of the other earlier work, the starting point is this kind of documentary and style or way of telling the story, that the actors speak through the camera to the audience. And in this, I wanted to create this fiction world, but still I wanted to have something to come out. When we were shooting, I told the actors that they can look, and I wanted them to look at the camera when it was natural. I thought about the ways how to kind of break the fiction.
One thing about filmmaking, clearly, that is a constant, I would imagine, is that it is entirely a collaborative venture. Although you write the thing and you're in charge, as it were, it requires an input from an enormous number of people. And you've worked collaboratively, actually, for most of your career.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Actually, I graduated as a painter, Then I made some photographs for a couple of years and some installation with photos and texts. And then I took some courses on video. And then I studied 1 year in London and 1 in Los Angeles. I studied film. And I like the way of working with moving image. And I really needed that there are other people there. I mean, it didn't suit me that I was alone in my studio the whole year round, you know. And now there's this time that I write, and I'm on my own in my own world, and then it ends, and there's this period when I'm working with a crew, and I've worked with these same people now with 4 productions, and we are starting to know each other well. It's co-production, and there's many people involved, and their creativity, and especially this time, I think it was really funny to have all the grown-up people working for something small and really seriously, like spending long hours, and people are really serious and working hard and for something which is fiction. You remember when I told you about the dream, the importance of something which is not food. When I was a young person, I wanted to be a lawyer because of my background, to help the people who don't have money and be their lawyer or something, idealistic. When I started, I think my work, you could see that they were feministic or political in a way, but then I became more interested in kind of expressing emotions and different views of seeing what is happening around you. I mean, I had a difficulty to really kind of see the meaning of doing something non-political or just the meaning of aesthetic or the meaning of beauty. I didn't feel fine, you know, I started to get depressed. And then one night I had this dream that I had in my hand a big white flower with kind of thick petals, and then I just brought my hand near my mouth and ate the flower. I thought that this is one of the finest dreams I've ever had, kind of solved my problem with the beauty and political.
I mean, camouflage, perhaps there isn't the best word, but it comes up much less overtly, although it seems to me to be very much there, all those questions about gender and politics and their relationship to the aesthetic. And they come up lightheartedly. There's an example when they're having their birthday party and there are 2 jokes told, one about the ideal man and one about the ideal woman. And also, as well as that, there is something quite important about location, it seems to me. Not to say that this is a finished work before it's anything else, but the fact that the narrative is set at the point in the spring when the ice is melting, the snow is melting, and there is that sense of change, and that seems to be an absolutely vital, larger kind of experience within a social space that echoes and mirrors the struggle between the couple themselves.
Yeah, I think you're right. When I was making this, there was this practical reason when I got the invitation to Venice. I knew that it's going to be spring, I'm going to shoot this. But then again, also when I was writing it, I remembered last year when I was making this Anarchy and God, that I had the same thoughts, you know, that it was already quite warm as a summer day, but then on the ditches where there was a shadow, you still had the snow there. And even here now, I've been thinking about nature and people and how we are part of the nature. You really can't avoid it, even if you live in the city.
The sound does seem to be extremely significant in the piece. It's very rich, dense web.
That's something actually what you lose a lot in an installation. We spent quite a long time considering the whole schedule, this time with sound, and I really enjoyed it. But in this room, and that's actually my own mistake, that I should have thought before, have a different roof and have a different floor so that there would be more elements which are soft, because in an echoing environment like that, you lose all the bass sound and then you get the treble. And that affects also to the mixing of the sound. For example, in the birthday scene, you don't hear very well the music, or sometimes you have only the words, and then you don't really get the whole of the idea of what the sound is there, what it does. For me, the sound is important because I think it has a straight line to the unconscious, or maybe I don't even want to use the word unconscious, but something that has to do with emotions. And emotions in this work, on the bottom there's this basic emotion which is which is sorrow. I think this is about sorrow, the work.
Do you think of what you're doing in any of these pieces as addressing particular narrative genres? I'm thinking particularly at the end of Consolation Service, where Anne, the wife, as it were, summons up the image of JP and goes to meet him, and then he disappears and he disappears, but he teaches us that Sandrick says to bow, to kind of accept something, to acknowledge. And this trio of partial encounters takes place in front of a large framed poster for an old Hollywood romance film.
I think a small clear example is this Miwi Okei Gray, the work where I wanted to explore the relationship of short films and advertisements.
So now I'm talking to Katie Deepwell. Katie, you're editor of a magazine being published in England called N.Paradoxa. So I was just wondering if you could first of all tell me a little bit about the magazine you publish.
Okay. N.Paradoxa is the only international feminist art journal in the world. It's international because the contributors come from different parts of the world and speak about different artists all over the world. For the Biennale, I'm concentrating on doing a picture roundup because this Biennale has the highest number of women artists for a very long time in any Biennale. This is not only in the Giardini, but it's also in the Harold Zeisman exhibition.
And are there any issues that this Biennale raises, do you think, or any themes that begin to emerge?
Well, regarding the women's work in the exhibition, the women artists who are definitely the strongest artists in terms of sculpture, installation and video work. This, I'd say, was generally a preoccupation of women artists in the world at the moment. Mixed media, sculpture and installation seem to be the strongest areas in which they work. There are exceptions, though. There's a woman from Scandinavia called Simone Alba Kern, who has done a very interesting piece, Women War Pilots. And she's presented paintings as an installation with sound, which is a nice interpretation, a kind of new way of presenting paintings. And the sound is the aircraft sound. It forms the backdrop to an analysis of the women pilots' experiences in the war.
Right. And the number of women artists, you say, in this Biennale is more so than any other Biennale in recent years. What do you attribute this to? Because the balance has often been in the opposite direction.
It's extremely hard to say what the factors for change are. Certainly, I think it's an enlightened awareness on behalf of the curators, generally. I also think it's because there's a tendency towards what you might call social sculpture, in the sense of trying to address current political issues, trying to address sensibility of a modern age, trying to address questions about history and memory. And all of those features are very strong in the women artists' work that have been chosen. There's also a very strong tendency towards analysing subjectivity, states of mind, presence of mind, what it actually means to be a human being in the moment. And I think that that is very present in, say, work like Louise Bourgeois, it's an obvious example, or Pippa Lotti-Rist, I think, would be another good example of someone who mixes all those trends together, particularly the piece that she's got here, Suburb Brain, which I think is a really wonderful piece of work.
Talking about the Biennale generally, there are arguments that suggest that perhaps the model of the Venice Biennale is somewhat anachronistic because it's identified by a sequence of national pavilions. I mean, do you think that the Venice Biennale in its present configuration has a relevance or a continuing role?
I think we have to live with the fact that the Venice Biennale is historically the most important Biennale in terms of European and American dealing, the art gallery scene behind the Biennale. This is probably why, if one was entirely able to construct the Biennale from the point of view of the art, it's truly an anachronism. But in the real world, where embassies pay for the export of their artists, and the export of those artists is very closely tied towards art market development, then I don't think we can get away from the kind of national pavilions.
There is another dimension this year in Venice, which is there's an enormous amount of work to be seen throughout Venice. It's not only in the gardens.
I thought this happened every year.
Well, it's increased this year because they've opened the boatyards. In a sense, there's less of a distinction. I mean, in 1985, when I first came, there was a real sense of the gardens were the real thing, and then there was some other stuff, young stuff, somewhere else, but it wasn't really considered to be as important, whereas I get a sense that Zeman really wants everything to be seen as equally important, the quieter interventions by younger artists maybe.
For me, the question of this Biennale is interesting because there are many, many artists from this Biennale who've also been shown in Manifesta. And Manifesta has certainly done a lot to raise the profile of East Europeans in the Biennales. And it's very clear that Zeman has been looking at Manifesta very closely. Many of the artists who are prominent in Manifesta have also appeared in the national pavilions. Emizer Benzkur is another very good example from Hungary. Who else could I think of? Kudluk Ataman, who did a very strong film, both in the Manifesta, this film about Semiha B, and then also here has done a very interesting four-screen video projection called Women Who Wear Wigs, which I think is a very good film.
So, I mean, what you seem to be saying is that there's space for all of these strategies, but, I mean, one of the things about the Biennale, it seems to be porous at the edges, and it seems to generate a lot of other things around it, but Biennale itself is not just a focus, but a kind of energising and enabling event.
I mean, there are probably as many people come to Venice as come to Documenta. So, in terms of the international art world getting together and exchanging ideas and swapping opinions and swapping notes, I think there still is a need for this kind of presentation.
That actually is a very important issue, isn't it? The discussion and debate that happens during these kinds of events is very much part of the defining provisional development of the events themselves. So finally then, when you go back and you are thinking about writing a piece in your magazine about this Biennale, how do you think it will be characterised?
Well, I'm neatly avoiding doing writing a piece because I'm doing this large photo spread, precisely because I want to show the range of different practices that women artists are doing. There's everything from Aaron Hamilton's presentation in the pavilion, which is a very minimalist installation, which is extremely hard to photograph and convey. There's Rosemary Trockel's fantastic video projection in the German pavilion, which has three parts to it, so you can't convey this in one photograph. There's the Hohenbuchler twins, Christine and Irene Hohenbuchler from Austria, have built this rather strange hut out of wood for Kosovan refugees. There's Anne Talantar's exhibition, which again is a two-part video work, which even though each piece on its own could be framed and seen as individual, nevertheless you'd need to see both. I think there, if anything, there would be a defining quality in trying to convey in pictures things that have to be physically experienced. And there seems to be an increasing tendency in contemporary art to have works of art which are almost impossible to photograph, precisely so that people appreciate the experience of being in a room, in an installation, in an environment, and considering the work itself.